This is Jeff Blankford. My guest today, who you heard before on Takes on the World, is Paul Pilar. Paul worked for the CIA for 28 years, during which time he rose to be one of the agency's top analysts and was the author in 2016 of Why America Misunderstands the World. His commentaries can be found in the National Interest and Consortium News, where I read the article I'm going to discuss with him today, Gazing at Iran Through a Distorted Glass. Welcome once again, Paul Pilar, to Takes on the World.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
You know, I'm happy to have you again. The article you wrote on the Iran protests, Gazing at Iran Through a Distorted Glass, seems to be very much in keeping with the theme of your book, Why America Misunderstands the World, that Americans, thanks no small part to our geographic isolation, are unable or unwilling to see what happens elsewhere in the world other than how such actions affect our domestic well-being.
That's right. And our interpretations of what's been going on in Iran, you know, reflect that in a number of ways. The protests that we witnessed, you know, had to do with a variety of reasons, most of which most Americans don't really understand at all. I mean, there were some very specific economic things having to do with some investment schemes that fell through and caused a number of ordinary Iranians to lose their money, that sort of thing. And there was the timing of an announcement of a budget by the Iranian president. It gets down to these sort of specific things, and yet the protests were looked at in and often described in a much more grandiose, general, non-specific way. We had op-eds in the Wall Street Journal by our hardline right with titles like "The Iranian Theocracy is on the Brink," that is to say, on the brink of collapse. Well, that's not the case. And when we see disruption in Iran, it really is a mixture of a lot of different things.
Well, actually, it seemed that this particular protest was initiated by hardliners to embarrass President Rouhani, and then it spread to other people in outlying areas outside of major cities like Tehran, and it represented a number of different thoughts and factions among the public. And as you say, you can't put this into one category, as so many of the op-ed writers and pundits did, trying to base it on some signs that they saw. You wrote about the significance or lack of same of particular signs in a crowd.
Yes, and you're right about apparently the beginning of this. The city of Mashhad, which is one of the larger cities, is a center of support for the hardline candidate who opposed Hassan Rouhani in the last presidential election. And the indications are the initial protests there, that's where they seem to start, were indeed an effort to try to embarrass Rouhani. And this has to do with the nuclear agreement and Rouhani, you know, having to defend that against hardline opposition. But things rapidly left the arena of control of the hardliners who started these protests in Mashhad, and all these other grievances came into play.
Well, one of the things that there's obviously some discomfort about in Iran is they thought that the nuclear deal with the United States and the P5 plus one countries would lift their economy, lift all boats, so to speak. But even with that deal, the United States still has such power that a number of countries or companies fear investing in Iran because they have to deal with U.S. banks and U.S. Treasury Department that is actually run as almost an agency of the Israeli government in determining who can be sanctioned and who shouldn't be.
There is an important dynamic here that you're underscoring. Those who have been opposed to the nuclear agreement, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, otherwise known as the Iranian nuclear deal, have argued that the economic problems of Iran are mostly of their own doing. And indeed, there are a lot of internal economic problems with regard to mismanagement and inefficiencies in the economy. But right now, in addition to some of the non-nuclear-related sanctions that the United States has firmly in place and has been expanding, in fact, as it's related to particular individuals, one of the main strategies for those trying to kill the nuclear agreement is to discourage normal economic commerce with an investment in Iran. And surveys of business executives of multinational corporations who either have been or are considering doing business in Iran clearly indicate that it is the fear of the long arm of the U.S. Treasury and of secondary sanctions and of what the Trump administration will do with regard to the nuclear agreement that is much more of a deterrent to doing business with Iran than all of those other factors, including the internal mismanagement problems. The strategy is to try to kill this deal, but make it look like it's the Iranians who are taking the initiative to kill it rather than the Americans. The hope is that at some point the Iranian leaders will throw up their arms and say, we just aren't getting the economic benefits, and so the deal is off, even if that absence of economic benefit really stems from the strategy of those back here in the United States and in Israel who have been trying to kill the whole thing.
Now, it's interesting that our European allies, who are certainly not pro-Iranian, were very restrained and were criticized for being restrained in response to the protests. And when Nikki Haley, who sometimes seems to represent Israel as much as the United States and the UN, went to the Security Council demanding Security Council take action, they just didn't want to listen to her. What does that tell us?
Well, as other members of the Security Council replied when Ambassador Haley tried to make this as an issue, they said this is not an issue of international security and threats to peace and security, which is what the UN Security Council is supposed to look at. This is an internal Iranian matter. I think also behind that, the European leadership quite wisely, and this was pretty much the perspective of the Obama administration when we had these earlier protests in Iran in 2009, which, by the way, were far bigger than these most recent ones. And that is to say that they realized that the more that they associated themselves as outside powers with internal dissent, that that does no political favors at all to those internal dissenters. In fact, it only serves to increase the credibility of the Iranian regime's contentions that such protests are externally fomented and that they aren't necessarily a reflection of internal problems. And I would add to all that, as far as the United States is concerned, given the Trump administration's perspective on so many things, ranging from the Muslim travel ban to the to other things that make it simply not credible that this administration is a champion of the Iranian people, that anything that associated the United States in particular with strong support for internal dissent would really increase the Iranian regime's credibility when they contend that this is all a matter of external interference. This is what the Europeans were thinking about.
Well, it's also interesting. It was revealed the end of last year, on the end of December, actually the day the protest began, December 28th, that on December 12th, there had been a meeting in Washington in which the U.S. and Israel had negotiated an agreement, a joint agreement, to work against the government of Iran. And a lot of people see the fine hand of the U.S. and Israel in at least in pushing some of these protests, because we know Israel had the ability at least to assassinate or have their agents in Iran assassinate five Iranian nuclear scientists over the years. And, of course, you mentioned the Mujahideen Khalq, which was considered a terrorist organization by Washington, until it changed its spots or the U.S. changed its position on Iran, has always been active there, trying to foment problems. What role do you think they may have had, or Israel might have had, or the United States may have had in pushing these protests, not initiating them, but pushing them?
I think this particular round of protests didn't last long enough for outsiders to have much of a role at all. And I don't think they initiated them, and we talked about the initiation as it related to what the hardliners were trying to do to Rouhani. But look, you know, they fizzled out basically in, you know, inside of 3 weeks. So I don't think that there was much in the way of outside machinations. Nonetheless, there is definitely that record, part of which you've summarized, involving the Israelis, involving the MEK, the Mujahideen Occult, the group that you referred to. And all of that is background that immediately comes to mind in any Iranian mind. Whenever the regime talks about external involvement, these are all factors that do, again, enhance the credibility of what the regime is saying. We might add as well, to be a little more specific about the MEK, the Mujahideen and Khalq, for listeners who aren't totally familiar with this. You know, this was an Islamic Marxist cult slash terrorist group. Which it goes back. They were opposing the regime of the Shah, and indeed they have American blood on their hands. They some of their earlier terrorist groups claimed American lives when we had a presence in Iran. They later had their own split with Khomeini's revolution, and later than that, they threw in their lot with Saddam Hussein and became basically an auxiliary to the Iraqi security apparatus, which is why they wound up in Iraq and their people at a couple of compounds in eastern Iraq became an issue after we invaded and took over that country. They have hardly any support in Iran. All the expert opinion I've seen shows that support is very, very small. And yet they have been funded well enough to get a lot of support, rhetorical and political support here in Washington. They have had some notable names who reportedly have gotten fat honoraria to speak on behalf of the group, to speak in their favor. And given all that lobbying and political support, they, under the previous administration, got their group delisted from the official U.S. group of foreign terrorist organizations. All that lobbying, all that financial support, of course, doesn't change the stripes of the group. And again, they certainly aren't a viable alternative as far as any support inside Iran is concerned.
Do you see the Trump administration keeps pushing the can down the road in trying to end the nuclear agreement, and most Americans, I suspect, would believe that its future is in the hands of Washington, because even the media totally discounts the fact that the other members of the Security Council are signatories as well as Germany, and Trump keeps saying they have to make changes in this agreement or we're going to step out, and not a single European country, even though they have different governments and may not disagree, agree with each other on other issues, agree on this issue that they should not open this agreement for renegotiation. What do you think the prospects are, if you could look in a crystal ball that's pretty cloudy, I guess, over there in Washington these days, what the future is for that agreement?
Well, Trump still wants very much to kill it. In doing so would be consistent with what seems to be the one consistent principle, you know, I use that term almost comically in this instance, of his foreign policy, which is to undo anything Barack Obama did and destroy any accomplishment he had. And of course, this relates to domestic policy as well as foreign policy. And The Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iran nuclear agreement, was probably the most single significant foreign policy achievement of Obama. The strategy that the administration appears to be following is partly based on what I described earlier, to foment enough doubt in the private sector, including the European private sector, banks and industries and investors, to discourage the kind of commerce that would lead to economic improvement in Iran, and also even violating not just the spirit but the letter of the agreement. You know, one of the clauses in the agreement says that the other parties besides Iran will not take any specific steps to try to interfere with the normal economic activity in Iran. Well, I'd say we've already violated that. You had the White House spokesperson at the G20 summit, for example, actively discouraging the other member countries from doing business with Iran. That was a pretty clear violation of that clause. And this goes back to the basic bargain of the nuclear agreement, that in return for the unprecedented degree of intrusive inspection and all the tearing back and tearing down of their nuclear program and the severe limits which no other country has subjected itself to voluntarily, in return for that, the Iranians understandably expected to get some economic improvement. And so it's not just a matter of waiving this or that sanction, but also refraining from these other things that will have the deleterious economic effect on Iran. So that's part of the strategy. The hope is still on the part of Trump and his administration that at some point the Iranians will give up and then they can be blamed for the crash of the agreement rather than the United States. Now, further issue that arises here, given that it is a multilateral agreement, as you pointed out, and the United States cannot unilaterally change it, is if 4 months from now or whenever Trump finally says, "All right, I'm formally, completely withdrawing the United States from this agreement," would the agreement still live without the United States? Well, that would depend on decisions not yet made in Tehran. I think most of the Europeans, as well as the Russians and Chinese, would make an effort to continue what amounted to the JCPOA minus the U.S. And then the issue becomes, would there still be enough economic improvement and normal commerce that the Iranians could enjoy that they would go along with that arrangement as well? In other words, something just with the other five powers and not with the United States. Again, I think the Iranian leaders would wait and see what happens, and they'd have to see what the effects of U.S. secondary sanctions would be and how hard the European governments worked to impose their own regulations to try to shield their private sector from that kind of thing.
One of the things that we've seen, of course, in covering the protests, we're trying to portray this as kind of a mass movement against Iran's support for Syria and Hezbollah and the government next door in Iraq. And while there were some signs like that, this seems to be part of a larger plan. I was going to shift to what's going on in Syria, which is very much related to this. Rex Tillerson, speaking in Stanford last week, talking about the permanent presence of U.S. forces in Syria, building up a Kurdish militia of 30,000 on Turkey's border. But one of the reasons the U.S. is going to stay is to keep Iran out of the region, to keep Iran out of Syria. The situation that's happening now, which I mentioned earlier before I called you in Turkey, seems to be the biggest crisis in the history of U.S.-Turkey relations, which go back to the end of the beginning of the Cold War when the U.S. brought Turkey into NATO, and Turkey has been one of America's most important, probably the most important ally in that region. How serious do you think this conflict is, where the Pentagon is saying one thing, the White House is saying something else? Can it get out of hand? Is there a possibility of a conflict between U.S. and Turkey? And where does you think Russia fits in? It's an amazing snarl that I've never, I don't think there's anything I've like ever seen about it in foreign policy. I don't know if you have, but we have allies who are enemies with our friends, and we have the Russians playing a strange role, which is difficult to figure. How do you see the situation from your where you are?
Well, the problem with the Turks in northern Syria is a very serious problem, but it's only one of the things entailed in the policy that was outlined in Secretary Tillerson's speech, and I wrote about that last week. And let me get to more of the general things in a moment. But first, with regard to the problem with the Turks, just to explain for your listeners, part of the American policy right now in Syria, going along with the continuation of having a direct U.S. troop presence there, is to support and build up a militia in northern Syria, which has already been a kind of client group of the U.S. Effort there, but the intention is to build it up even farther. And it is Kurdish fighters who dominate this group, even though there are some Arabs involved as well. And the Turkish government, which always, of course, is very nervous about anything having to do with militancy or separatism on the part of Kurds, whether it's in the adjoining countries as well as their own, charges with some good reason that there is a strong association between these Syrian Kurds and what's known as the PKK, which is the Turkish Kurdish terrorist group, which conducted a guerrilla war and a terrorist campaign for years and years. And so it's quite understandable that Ankara is so angry to the point that they've now initiated their own military operations in northern Syria about the United States supporting this Kurdish-dominated group right on their southern border. Now, you've got the further problem, which you mentioned in passing, about different messages from the White House and the Pentagon, and the messaging has been a problem. When some of this plan for support of this Kurdish-dominated militia was talked about before, it was described here in Washington as a border force. And, well, this didn't help alleviate the Turkish concerns at all. So some of the more recent rhetoric is more, well, it's not really a border force. It's going to continue to be focused against any remnants of ISIS. But all of this, Jeff, is part of some of the bigger problem that I see in the departure, and it really is a departure that was marked by what Secretary Tillerson described at his Stanford speech. We went into Syria ostensibly because of ISIS, this one group that was successful enough to take over a large amount of territory in western Iraq and eastern Syria. So it presented a military target. It was like a mini-state. And that's what it was supposed to be all about. Well, now the mini-state is almost totally extinguished. Secretary Tillerson himself said it was, 98% of the land has been reclaimed, and ISIS has not been able to get anything back in return over the last few months. In other words, as a military target, ISIS has lost. It's still going to be a problem as a extremist inspiration and more of a sort of ordinary terrorist group that inspires lone wolves elsewhere, that sort of thing. But that's not anything that a military force in a foreign country like Syria is going to do much good to try to combat. Instead, we've shifted to different missions. One is, and Secretary Tillerson's speech was quite explicit about this, we still apparently haven't given up regime change in Syria. He talked about we need post-Assad leadership. Whether you like it or not, the Syrian civil war has had a history over these last couple of years, and with the backing of the Russians and the Iranians, the Assad regime has been doing pretty well. They're not going away anytime soon, whether you like that or not. And then the secretary was also talking, as this administration always talks, about anything in the Middle East, well, we've got to combat Iranian influence. And nothing was ever said about what exactly affects U.S. interests with regard to the Iranian alliance with and presence in Syria. How does that hurt us? And it was never explained. And I think the closest thing to an explanation anyone comes up with is, well, you know, they could do, you know, harm to our troops. Well, that gets to the issue, why are our troops there? You know, I think our troops are going to be, unfortunately, you know, a target and a further inspiration for anti-U.S. extremism. It's seen as an occupying force. And as the Russians constantly remind people, look, they said our forces, as well as the Iranian forces, are there by the invitation of the incumbent government. Your forces are not there. You've been supporting rebels, and you're still supporting rebels. This is a mess. And finally, I would just add, none of this has been, besides being contrary to international law in terms of having a military force there that's without the invitation of the host government, U.S. law says the U.S. Congress is supposed to authorize the overseas use of military force. Well, we've had these couple of resolutions, you know, in the first year or two before after 9/11, which had to do with counterterrorism and have been stretched in various ways to try to justify the deployment of military forces hither and yon. Now where we're going in Syria, even if you just read the very words of Mr. Tillerson's speech, there's no conceivable way in which those previous resolutions would apply at all, even with a stretch.
What's interesting is, in all the discussion of the Trump presidency, there is no discussion, no criticism from either party, certainly not from the Democrats, of what the U.S. is doing in the Middle East or anywhere else on the planet. It's like we have isolated ourselves geographically, even in this information age with the smartphones and accessibility to more information, if not knowledge. The gap's probably never been wider between the two. We might be on the eve of a war even in Korea, and yet we have protests around the country about dealing with many important domestic issues, but nobody seems to be concerned about what the U.S. military is doing around the world. Obama, when he came into office, took over a kind of moribund, or it hadn't even flowered yet, AFRICOM. And by the time he left, we had soldiers in 50 African states, and American never discussed in Congress. No discussion in Capitol Hill, and by the pundits, the op-eds, nothing about it. It's like the United States military, with the end of the draft, has become like a mercenary force, which is at the service of you name it. But I don't. What is your take on all this? The fact that there is no debate or discussion of what the U.S. military is doing anywhere.
Well, it's become the new normal, especially since 9/11, and now we're going on 17 years after 9/11. Terrorism, of course, is always going to be with us. There's no way we can end it. It's been a technique used for millennia, literally. So there's never going to be a conclusion to a so-called war on terror, which is part of the reason I always despise that particular term. And so having overseas military expeditions in all these different countries has become the new normal. It's become accepted. We've had a whole generation coming of age that has known nothing but that. You referred to the absence of conscription, and I think that is a major, major difference from what we've had in the past. You know, I was just over the holidays talking to my now in their 20s children about what it was like when I was a college student, which in the 1960s during the Vietnam War, and how much that war, given the existence in particular of the draft, was just the overwhelming issue that suffused public discussion everywhere. I mean, it was particularly intense on college campuses, of course, for obvious reasons. But it was something that really affected homes throughout America, and we don't have that anymore. And so we have had this tendency to compartmentalize the costs of these sorts of things because it hasn't directly affected most Americans in a personal way. And this goes back to the first couple of years after 9/11, when then President Bush told people to go shopping as their particular response to this war on terror. It is the new normal, and unfortunately, I don't see a way of getting out of it anytime soon.
This is, we have 17 years now in Afghanistan, and who would see the 25th year? Who would bet against that? And now the president of Syria, if there is not going to be any kind of opposition to the U.S. military being in a country in which there is no legal sanction, I mean, it's a stretch to use the legislation passed after 9/11, which there was some effort to change early in the years of Obama administration, but that failed, and now there doesn't seem to be any pressure on from either party to actually enact new legislation or actually reinvigorate the War Powers Act that was passed by Congress to counter President Nixon. That was an amazing period when that happened. And they had hearings and legislation and so on. And I remember at the time in 1969 to defend President Nixon, Senator Dirksen, the senior Republican from Illinois, introduced on the Senate floor a list of all the interventions outside of world wars that had been ordered individually by American presidents since the beginning of the nation. And by 1973 or something like that, there were over 250, and that was his argument, that there was a precedent for the president acting alone without Congress. And so Congress wasn't buying that and passed the War Powers Act, but we're actually again back to that same practice that previous presidents had used. They really have ignored Congress, and Congress has allowed it to happen. Again, you don't see any change in that. I'm afraid I don't either. But what do you think of the prospects and the immediate are for the situation in Syria? The Russians have kind of, I've read their news reports, they're kind of staying on the sideline. But Russia has had agreements with Turkey around this. And they also, Iran has criticized Turkey, saying they should be out of Syria. Sometimes these countries are working together and sometimes they're not. Is there a larger war that could develop and expand the Syrian war and make this just an endless scene of fighting?
Well, you know, most of the other governments involved, including especially the Russians, you know, realize fully in a way that we seem to have trouble realizing that this conflict, like a lot of others, is complex. It doesn't simplify into clear lines between good guys and bad guys. That they share some interest with some of the other actors and they conflict with some of the other actors. You mentioned, you know, Russians and Turks having talks. Well, they've still got a lot of conflicting interests, but they also are willing to do business with each other and reach modus vivendi for getting things done to achieve their particular objectives. The Russians have, for the most part, achieved the objective they wanted to achieve, which was to shore up the Assad regime when it was seemed to be on possible for it to collapse, and to come back and reestablish itself in the populated areas of Syria and recapture most of the major cities like Aleppo, which it has. And in so doing, other Russian objectives included, you know, making the point that Russia is a force to be reckoned with and a major player in the Middle East, and particularly to retain their long, long association going back through the Soviet era with the Syrians. The thing that disturbs me most about the U.S. policy, as reflected in Secretary Tillerson's speech, is that's just a prescription for prolonging the division of Syria and conflict in Syria and lengthening the civil war, and that doesn't do anybody any good. If we're worried about terrorists and extremists, it's continuation of the war that would promote extremism more than anything else. It was the war itself, not just the regime, that gave ISIS the opportunity to make its big gains, you know, 3 or 4 years ago. So to have this policy that involves continuing to divide and prevent to divide the country and prevent any economic cooperation among the different parts of the country that would lead to a better life for Syrians. That's not a prescription for stability. It's not a prescription for counterterrorism, and I don't see how it advances U.S. interests at all. My overall prescription for the, or not prescription, but a prognostication for Syria in the years ahead is more division, and the war will continue.
Very quickly, because we're running down to the end of the hour, but there's constant talk in the Israeli press about the next war with Hezbollah, and conceivably that would also take place in Syria. And the Israelis have continually shelled Syrian targets without retaliation, because Syria obviously doesn't want a war with Israel. In about 30 seconds, do you think there's a possibility of another war with Lebanon, with Israel, Hezbollah in Lebanon, on Israel's part, to take advantage of the situation?
I don't think either side seeks an all-out war right now, but the possibility of some incidents leading to one is significant. You know, we've had in the past instances of a capture of one person or somebody straying across some line being the trigger where both sides are ready to respond. And I think the chance of that is significant, even though neither side would like an all-out war.
Where can people find your most recent article on Syria?
At the National Interest, nationalinterest.org.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading it myself. I didn't see it, and I very much look forward to reading it, and recommend my listeners do that as well. Paul Pilar, I want to thank you for being our guest today. A very interesting discussion on a very important topic. Look forward to talking with you again.
Okay, you're welcome. My pleasure.
Take care. Bye-bye. And that was Paul Pilar, former CIA analyst, giving his take on what's happening within Iran and in Syria. Next Wednesday, January 31st, as I mentioned earlier, is the fifth Wednesday of the month and my time to take over the program. And it'll be your turn to share your takes on the world with KZYX listeners, while Joy LeClaire will be back on February 7th with Fourth Right Radio. Today's program, as well as others over the past 60 days, can be found on KZYX's jukebox, and programs still further back can be found by searching online for Jeff Blankfort Radio. Stay tuned now for Pulse of the Planet, followed by Patrick Gomes with interlude from our Mendocino studios. The time is now just about 9:59. This has been Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.